You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Frances Lam grew up in New Jersey to Chinese-American parents who dreamed of him becoming a dentist or a lawyer. But when he said he wanted to be a writer, well, they weren't exactly thrilled. But then they saw that first byline and they were convinced. Frances would then go on to be a multiple James Beard Award-winning food writer and the host of the popular food and culture show, The Splendid Table. He joins me now. Frances Lam, welcome.
Thank you, Hannah.
Well, welcome to the show and welcome to KLW and actually welcome to the San Francisco airwaves.
It is truly such a thrill. Like I can't even say how excited we are that we get to be on your air.
Again, new to our airwaves, the show for curious cooks and eaters. That sounds like you're describing everyone in the Bay Area, basically. This show was made for here.
We have been wanting to be there for a long time.
But for folks who are getting this for the first time, how would you describe the show? What is it supposed to do?
Oh, boy. Okay, so, you know, the show's been around for nearly 25 years.
Right.
And with the previous host, Lynn Rosetta Casper, who's a hero of mine, wonderful. She, you know, I think the show was known as a cooking show. She was a fabulous cooking teacher. She, in fact, like ran cooking schools for many years. And I came up as a fan listening to the show. And my career prior to being on the show was similar in that I feel like we had very similar interests, but I wrote less about cooking and the how-tos of cooking, although I did do plenty of that. It's something I am passionate about for sure. But a lot of my stories as a writer were about telling the stories of invisible people and first connecting to them through food. Mm. So I had a column for a few years at the New York Times Magazine where every month I would go into the home of someone who was from a different immigrant community in New York City, and they would teach me to make something, but in the course of our cooking together, they would usually teach me something about their lives or something about where they came from or their hopes and dreams. Or sometimes the stories would be incredibly personal, incredibly beautiful and heartbreaking. And for me, I always felt like, well, man, if so, this person is sharing this with me, it's not just a gift to me, but now it's a responsibility of mine to take that story and help put it out in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of feel like we do this show that is definitely in the tradition of the show that Lynn started 20-some-odd years ago, but now with maybe a little bit more of an eye towards the cultural element of food, maybe a little bit more of an eye towards the personal stories, maybe a little bit more of an eye towards the politics of what we're eating. Again, these are things the show has always dealt itself. These are things the show has always dealt with. But I think now we're just freer to be a little more curious and not think of ourselves so focused as a cooking show. Mm-hmm. And we are a show about curiosity.
Because the stories of people add what?
You know, I think it's not even about what they add. It's sort of like what the food lets us get to. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to say, well, the food tastes better if you know the story behind it. It's a little bit of a truism in food, and it's fair. But for us, it's not even like, hey, I want to talk to you about your tacos, and then let's talk about, like, where you came from. You know, it's more like, I'm really curious about what you've seen and who you are as a person and what you're interested in. And if I were to meet you in a bar and I didn't know how to talk to you, maybe the first thing I would do is ask you about what you ate when you were growing up. Mm-hmm. And that's like, it's almost like the icebreaker. And because we can share a lot in common there, and I can tell you what I ate and what's delicious and what you're excited about and what you want to eat, you know, what you're excited to eat this weekend or mm-hmm. whatever. And then once we've established that as a baseline, a way to sort of connect, it's almost like if the metaphor was like, oh, now like the wires are crossed, like we've crossed our wires, and then we can have like full transmittal and full transmission, and mm-hmm. we can talk about other things too. I feel like the story often for me starts with the food and goes anywhere else mm-hmm. rather than have the story and end in the food.
Mm-hmm. Who cooked at home? What kind of household did you grow up in terms of food and cooking?
Well, okay. So the question of who cooked at home is it wasn't really my parents. I don't remember my dad cooking ever at all. Mm-hmm. I do remember him making the only, we don't have to get into this, but there are two things I ever remember my dad really making. And one of them was white bread toast with peanut butter and enough sugar on top that made it crunchy. And it's incredible. So I remember him making that as a snack for me. I remember him wrapping wontons once. Uh-huh. And it was a shock to me because I was a teenager at this point. I'd never seen my dad in the kitchen. I was like, whoa, what's he doing? And he just sat there at the counter. Someone had made a big bowl of wonton filling, and he had the wrappers, and he was wrapping them very naturally. Like the motion came very quickly to his hands. And I remember asking him, like, Dad, what are you doing? How'd you learn to do it? Like, it was just such a, I just never saw him in the kitchen. And he just very casually said, like, oh, you know, when I was, when I first got to this country, I was a waiter in a Chinese restaurant that would make us wrap the dumplings. And it was one of those moments where, you know, you realize you've literally known this person your whole life. And there's so many things about them you've never known. Because as a child, you're self-centered and narcissistic, and you never actually bothered to ask your parents about their lives.
Sure. The American-born child, too.
Yeah, for sure, right? So so that was my dad, like my cooking story with my dad. And my mom didn't really cook for us when I was growing up. My parents worked in New York City. I grew up in New Jersey. They worked, you know, sort of like an hour commute away, and they worked really late. So they would come home at like 9:30 every night. Mm-hmm. So we always had either grandparents staying with us, or often we'd have, you know, a nanny who would take care of us, who would also do the cooking. Mm-hmm. So we had this, in a sense, a very traditional Chinese family, in that it was kind of, it takes a village.
Right.
And everyone sort of pitched in when they could.
Right.
And my mom eventually started cooking for us after we got to the point where, you know, they couldn't afford / they didn't need to have someone looking after us all the time anymore. But by that point, my mom had been a vegetarian for probably 10 years. So, and she cooked meat for us, and she never tasted anything that she made.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's... Huh. That's my who cooked at home answer.
That's your who cooked at home. That's at home. So you grew up in New Jersey with Chinese food for sure, right? And so you grow up and you're in school. Was your area and your school diverse enough that you didn't have to be like hiding your lunches at school like a lot of us had to do because we were embarrassed?
Oh, no, this is a conversation I find myself in all the time. I mean, literally yesterday I was talking to someone who's a terrific chef here in Minneapolis, an award-winning chef. And when you start talking to, you know, kids who grew up in places where there weren't a lot of kids like them, as she did, as I did, you will always run into the stinky lunchbox story, you know, and I definitely had the stinky lunchbox. I remember being in a grade school where, you know, kids had their bologna sandwiches and with mayonnaise, and they looked like magic. Like, what I wouldn't give for Michael Raleigh's salami and mayonnaise sandwiches, which, you know, to me looked and tasted like heaven. They also looked and tasted like, quote, normal food, like, quote, normal kids had, right? And I had a lunchbox where instead of juice in the thermos or milk in the thermos or chocolate milk in the thermos, it was my lunch in the thermos. And it was Chinese food, you know, leftover from the night before, and it always smelled like something, right? It didn't ever just smell like a ham sandwich. And so kids would look. And I don't remember that many, like, hostile interactions. You know, I don't remember that many kids, like, giving me a hard time about it. But I definitely remember being very self-conscious about it, and very self-conscious of how different it was, and self-conscious of how it smelled. And, that was a long time. And then eventually, I think I... you know, would come home and just say, like, Mom, I just, you know, can't you just make me a ham sandwich, and so I can be a normal kid? And so eventually she, you know, got me disposable paper bags and got me the ham sandwich, you know, got deli ham from the, you know, she figured it out.
Yeah, I remember I came home just wanting just peanut butter and jelly sandwich in my strawberry shortcake lunchbox.
Right.
And I just wanted to feel normal. And like this takes me to this point about this idea of preserving heritage. Mm. You know, I'm a second generation. I cook our foods at home, right? So, and my kids, thankfully, like it. and it feels like if we don't eat our food, there's something lost. Like, it's my job to keep this culture going. And I wonder if that'll end. You know, I have this like nagging feeling. Will this end with my kids or my kids' kids? It's like deep because food represents heritage. You know, how important do you think this was in your family? And do you think about this today with your family?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have a young child myself. We think about it in terms of language a lot right now because, you know, she's learning to speak and she's gotten to the age now where she can speak really, like she's really verbal and she speaks in English but it's so fun to talk with her, right? Like as a parent, when you get your kid to the point where you can actually have a conversation with your kid, it's so fun. It's so exciting.
And she calls you Baba. Right? I heard that in an episode.
Well, that's a thing. Somehow, somewhere along the line, she switched and now I'm daddy.
Oh, ooh. Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know what it was. I don't know. And, you know, we kind of like when I refer to myself to her or when my wife refers to me to her, like we'll use the word, the term Baba, you know, which is what I call my dad. In Cantonese Chinese, which is what we spoke at home when I was a kid. But somewhere along the line, it switched. I became daddy. And I'm not like forcing her, I'm not pressuring her. You know, we kind of just feel like, you know, these things will come and that's symbolic, but it's not really the end of the world.
And is food kind of like that, like language?
I think so. I mean, she's... Well, here's my problem too. I don't cook that much Chinese food at home.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few dishes... There's truly only one dish that I make that I think of as being a quote-unquote traditional dish. And that formulation is kind of weird and problematic in its own way. You know, I have this whole thing with like, well, what's authentic food really mean? Because food always evolves, right? But there's one dish that maybe just simply put, like, is a dish that I could have seen on my table growing up.
What is it?
The vast majority of my cooking. It's stir-fried eggs with tomatoes that we would eat with rice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's delicious. I love it. There's like some ginger and some scallion and tomato sauce. And it, you know, but it's very simple and it's quick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often why a lot of, if you go on the internet, you like Google Chinese tomatoes and eggs. Like it's like every you know, Chinese, you know, every food blogger of any sort of Chinese ancestry will at some point post about how this dish and makes them cry when they eat it because it reminds them of their mama. Uh-huh. You know, it's like one of those dishes. But that's it. And most of my cooking is not Chinese in style.
So you don't feel this burden like me? I mean, I almost feel like it's like, you know what I mean? Just like my ancestors are looking down on me. And this big thing, like this epic responsibility where, you know, for real. If you're good, I'm going to be good, Francis Lam. I'm going to be easier on myself.
I mean, we might have different ancestors.
Yeah. Right?
mine are like knocking on my door for other reasons. But no, I hear you. I hear you for sure. And I do think that's a real thing. And I do think, you know, my child, you know, my wife is, her family's Portuguese. Her parents came from there. So she's a child of immigrants. And we share a lot of experiences and we share a lot of perspectives based on the experience of being the children of immigrants. But from totally different places, right?
Right.
So there's commonality we share in terms of our experience and how we see the world, but sort of like the cultural DNA is very different. So what that means in our home too is, yes, absolutely, we want our child to speak Cantonese and we want our child to speak Portuguese and we want her to grow up with Portuguese food and with Chinese food. But, you know, we don't have the answer for how that's going to happen.
Right.
And it's a little bit trickier when you are, you know, it's not both of you coming from the same place, right? But
sure. And then there's this term authentic that's problematic, as you said. What does that even mean today? You know, and you've used this term re-artisanalizing. I you know, that was hard to say. Yeah. But what is going on right now, do you think, with authenticity and what's authentic and what's not? Like, if my daughters add an ingredient later on in their lives to a food that I brought to them, what is that? Is it authentic anymore?
You know, I think it's a tricky question, and it's sort of why I take exception to when people want to talk about food in terms of authenticity. I mean, it's not like it's meaningless. We know what it means, right? It's just hard to define.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things, like, you know it when you see it, but when you have things that are...
Or taste it.
Yeah, exactly. But when you have things that are like in that sort of realm of definition, it's squishy, and we load too much meaning and too much import on it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm talking too abstractly. Maybe the easier way to say it is like this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's talk about a cuisine, for instance, just hypothetically. Oh, is that restaurant authentic Chinese food or is it not? Well, I know what you mean. What you mean is it, you know, the Golden Panda Empress Takeout Garden?
Mm.
Or is it, oh, a place that, you know, quote, Chinese people go and eat at? Right? That's kind of what you mean.
Right.
And you want it to be the place where, quote, Chinese people go and eat.
Right.
Because what you think is the food there will taste like the food as you would have it in China. Okay? So we know what that means. But, okay, let's actually look at that a little bit. Is that dish authentic? Okay, that means, is it authentic to China? Well, okay, well then what part of China? And what region of China? And then what town or city or village? And what person cooking it? And frankly, is it authentic to 2019? Or is it authentic to 1974? Or 1945, or, you know, 1242 BC,
mm-hmm.
because food has always changed. So there's no such thing as quote unquote authentic food in the way that we're talking about it, even though we all know what we mean when we say it. And the reason why I think it's a problem to talk about in those terms is because I think it also creates like unfair expectations of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives us a reason to dismiss people and their work if it doesn't fall under our, frankly, shoddy definition of what quote-unquote authentic should mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah. So like many immigrant parents, yours wanted you to become a doctor, a dentist, an engineer. Oh, I mean, this is so familiar. Sounds
sure.
So familiar. For where I come from, where many people, I think, have heard this throughout their lives. And,
for
you know,
sure.
We talk about it a lot in our communities, and it kind of makes sense because of where our families came from. Those are the kind of the money-making, stable jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I went and said I wanted to be a writer or a journalist, it would be like, huh. You know, what is that writer? You
know? We didn't come here for this.
We didn't come all the way over here for you to become a writer.
Yeah.
So your parents, I think, fit within that, you know, kind of narrative.
For sure.
But eventually they started supporting you when?
Well, oh boy. I had to break their heart like a bunch of different times.
Mm.
First, when I told them I wasn't going to go to medical school, I didn't have the grades for it. You know, I wasn't gonna, yada, 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 all the way down the line. And maybe it just got to the point where I wore them down enough. We're like, oh my God, you have a job? Good for you.
Mm.
Yeah. But I actually do remember when I graduated from college. I went to school at the University of Michigan, stayed in Ann Arbor for a couple of years doing different things that, you know, frankly, to me, were just exciting to do. I was working as a cook. I was working as a server. I was doing a bunch of different things that I just thought were like, wow, this is, I love this life that I'm living. And they were kind of like, okay, cool. You're still like trying to do, you're doing that thing that we hear, you know, American kids do, like find themselves. Like, yeah. We never had the time to find ourselves, but okay, fine. You get a couple years doing
that.
It's
very American. Yes.
Yeah. Right. And then I moved to New York. And I got a job, and I thought they would be so pleased, like, because I got a job like that involved a desk. I was working at a nonprofit, like a community development organization in Chinatown. And when they heard I was working in Chinatown, like it struck a chord in a way that was not happy for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my mom in tears talking to me on the phone, saying, "We worked for 25 years in Chinatown, so that you never would have to." And You know, and it was like, you know, I think it was definitely like she was processing some stuff, right? Yeah. Like it wasn't about the job. The job seemed fine, but it was just something about the idea that I went back to this place. And not like they hate it. Like when they come visit me, they don't live in the area anymore, but when they come visit, like we'll go and we'll eat and we'll shop there. It's fine. It's like, but it was just that idea of our child fitting himself back into this life or even something close to the life that we had, even physically proximate to the life that we had, that was heartbreaking to them. Mm. You know, and they did well. Like I feel like I grew up with a lot of privilege. Like they had a profession, they had a business, they, you know, they provided us with food and, you know, comfort and education and all this. I felt like they did great.
They just didn't want you back working in Chinatown where they struggled for
right.
so long. Yeah.
Right, you know? Mm-hmm. As to your question of when they started supporting me, you know, I eventually told them I wanted to go to culinary school, and they actually felt that was a good thing, which I thought was surprising because it's really hard to make a living mm-hmm. in, you know, as a cook. But they, eventually I started writing about food, and I mailed them a copy of a story. My first story that ever appear in print was in a newspaper, and actually was like the featured story, the cover story of the weekend section of the paper. Mm-hmm. And they were blown away. Mm. They literally have it framed in their house to this day.
Oh my gosh.
And like, that's our son, you know, like that was sweet.
Yeah. Bay Area. Lots of variety, richness in the food scene here, as we said. Mm-hmm. Where do you go when you're in town?
Oh, man, you're going to make me pick?
Other than boba, guys.
I mean, I have to say, really, truly, and this is like, how do I put this? Yeah, I think the East Coast, West Coast beef is over. Like, it was over in rap a long time ago, and I think it probably ended in food, too. But the fact is, like, pound for pound, there is no city in the country, probably the world, that has a food scene that can match the Bay Area's. I mean, the richness of climates, the richness of produce you have, the richness of the diversity of communities, although I know, obviously, that the it's tricky to say that in a place that's like really dealing a lot with gentrification and people being priced out of their own communities, but the richness of heritages and cultures that have come there over time, and the richness of like innovation and in chefs, the chef community there that really pushes, you know, where people really push each other to do new things and do exciting new things. And frankly, a market that appreciates that and also, like, at certain segments of society has the money and willingness to spend that money on that really creates for, like, a top-to-bottom food scene that is unlike anything in the country.
It's a wonderful, wonderful show, so thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And I'm going to end by asking a question that, as a journalist, you probably ask all the time as well at the beginning of an interview, because it would be lovely to hear, what did you have for breakfast this morning, Francis Lamb?
Oh, this
it
is
better
like the
be
ultimate
good. No pressure.
Studio engineer question. Yeah, like just to get a level, what did you have for
just
breakfast?
Just to get a level, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Okay, my truth is this. I almost never eat breakfast. I know it's the most important meal, yada yada. I almost never eat breakfast, and I did not eat breakfast today. However, I will tell you that I heard one of my favorite answers to that question while I was sitting in this very studio and interviewing someone else, a James Beard Award-winning food media person, and he said, man, I had a bowl of Cap'n Crunch.
Oh, no. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
My other favorite answer to that question was when someone was like, oh, and she was like trying to think of like what she might say that would sound like appropriately foodie. And she's like, I had cigarettes.
Well, we know not to ask any James Beard Award winners that question anymore.
We are just like the rest of y'all.
Cat and crunch. Okay. Well, Francis Lam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Francis Lam is host of the podcast The Splendid Table from American Public Media. You can hear it every Saturday at 1 p.m. right here on KALW.